Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Creation and Human Life Seminar here at Calvary. All of the sessions will be taped and be made available at the end of this weekend, and we hope you will find information that will be pertinent to the issues at hand. There is a current piece of news in this regard in the Orange County Register, in which it says, case for creationism has its missing links. There's a charge here that creationism never presents its evidence on its side, but only chooses to attack the evolutionary arguments. Interesting. Well timed. Hope you read it. Glad you're here. We're going to try to present to you the case for creationism and catastrophism that, in fact, we believe is taught in the Scriptures in the Bible. We are not going to have any unnecessary details of our seminar this weekend. We're here to learn and to grow. We hope you have pencil and paper in hand. There are many wonderful publications that are available to you that we'll mention more about before our evening's over, and you can purchase after the final session tonight. Our speaker for our first seminar session, I'm happy to introduce Dr. Stephen Austin. Dr. Austin is the associate professor and head of the geology department of the Institute of Creation Research in El Cajon. He has degrees in geology from the University of Washington, San Jose University, as well as a Ph.D. From State University in Pennsylvania. He has published a number of research papers and is known as the author of an outstanding publication that is here and available tonight. The subject is Catastrophes in Earth History. And tonight we're going to hear that presentation. Let's give a warm welcome to Dr. Stephen Austin.
Good to be here tonight, and I'm looking forward to a very thought-provoking and challenging lecture on Mount St. Helens and the power of God as it's visible in nature. And we'll have the lights. We'll begin with the slides. The eruption of Mount St. Helens is sure to be remembered as one of the most significant geologic events of our generation, in fact, the whole 20th century. When people look back on the 20th century from the next century and say, what happened there in the 20th century, at least geologically, they're going to remember Mount St. Helens. That's the way I remember Mount St. Helens before the eruption. I went to school at the University of Washington in Seattle 4 years and had many opportunities to drive around the mountain and even fly around it and walk on it. Most beautiful landscape that can be imagined, lush forest and timbered country. And that volcanic eruption in 1980 changed the whole figure of that mountain. In the next few minutes, I'd like to explain to you a little bit about what a volcano is like, and hope my slides convince you of the power and the force of volcanoes a little bit. But what a volcano is like, it's very interesting what a volcano can do. And secondly, I'd like you to understand a little bit about myself, what I am doing as a creationist and as a catastrophist geologist, one who believes in catastrophic process that has formed a large part of our Earth. And so my personal involvement in the volcano. Geologists are like Boy Scouts. Instead of trading patches or baseball trading cards, we trade slides. And I was able to trade for some of these slides. So some of them are also mine. I have some of the finest slides you'll see on the eruption of Mount St. Helens. Third thing I'd like you to understand is a little about what a volcano can do in very short order. At Mount St. Helens, we had accomplished in very short period of time tremendous geologic changes. And they're incredible. It's a Ripley's, believe it or not. They challenge our way of thinking about how the Earth works. And then finally, I'd like you to think about the power of God visible in a volcano, such as Mount St. Helens, and contemplate what that says about our power and about God's power. The volcano before the eruption was 9,677 feet tall, very beautiful Spirit Lake just north of the summit. Upside-down ice cream cone, very conical shape appearance to it. The right screen shows what the volcano looked like from that same angle after the eruption. It went from 9,677 feet down to 8,365 feet. It lost 1,300 feet of its summit, just got lopped off the top. and 1/2 cubic mile of the summit slid off on the morning of May 18, 1980, in the largest landslide ever witnessed and photographed by man. 1/4 of the landslide debris went down into Spirit Lake Basin here. That's 1/8 of a cubic mile of rock slit and ice and summit slid off down into the Spirit Lake Basin. And 3/8 of a cubic mile, or 3/4 of the material, went down to the west over the North Toutle River. Even some of it went over this ridge. You can see that hummocky topography. Well, all of that unleashed the tremendous amount of super hot liquid water that was inside the volcano. And within seconds after the landslide left, after the Richter magnitude 5.1 earthquake shook the summit, the summit had left, and the super hot liquid water flashed to steam. In a matter of seconds, 20 million tons TNT explosion energy was directed not up into the air, but over the landscape to the north of the volcano. And 150 square miles of forest was leveled in 6 minutes by this super hot blast of steam that was directed over the landscape. It's kind of like a soda pop bottle. You know, when you have the cap on the bottle, no fizzing occurs. That summit was producing pressure that was holding the water in the volcano, and the effect of steam power is amazing. Here you see the old profile of the volcano and the new profile. This would not be the place to be standing on the morning of May 18th taking that picture. Mount St. Helens has a history of lava flows, and the old profile of the volcano, you can see an old lava flow covered with snow at this photograph. So the volcano can behave explosively or can behave more tranquilly like the Hawaiian volcanoes and give off lava flows. The Mount St. Helens is an interlayered volcanic ash and lava flows building up this steep-sided cone. Call this a stratovolcano or composite cone volcano. We have one of these volcanoes right here in California, Mount Shasta. Also Mount Hood in Oregon, Mount Rainier in Washington, Mount Fuji in Japan. I guess you'd call Krakatoa over in Indonesia, that one that erupted in 1883. That's the same kind of volcano. Mount Vesuvius in Italy, and even Mount Ararat in Turkey. Those are, all of these volcanoes are this kind of volcano, the ticking time bomb that can give off lava flows that move at 10 miles an hour or steam blast clouds that move at 200 miles an hour. This shows the beginning of the eruption. I remember middle of March 1980 when the news came over the radio, earthquake directly under Mount St. Helens. I think it was the 14th of March 1980. And within a week, my favorite volcano was active, and it vented steam from the summit. Here's the first steam eruptions, 21st of March 1980, I believe. And it came back after the first steam belched from the summit, and there was a little pit there at the summit, and all kinds of cracking going on. Then it erupted ash high into the atmosphere. Here's the first volcanic ash coming out of the summit. Notice its profile is still very symmetrical before the May 18th eruption. Then they came back and there were two pits at the summit. Then it erupted volcanic ash very high into the atmosphere. Went way up high. And then they came back, and the two pits at the summit had merged into one pit, and there's an airplane for scale. Okay, the summit is immense and tremendous size. Then the morning of May 18th, this is one of the last photographs that was taken on the morning of May 18th before the catastrophic eruption. There's the sun rising in the east, and here is the profile of Mount St. Helens. During that period between March, April, and May 1980, between March and May 1980, the geologist had made a dreadful discovery. And the discovery was this, that the north slope of the volcano was bulging at 3 to 5 feet a day over that 90-day period. And on May 16, May 17, those 2 days, that north slope of the volcano right here was bulging at 50 feet a day. So on the morning of May 18th, there was over 300 or 400 feet of bulging on the north slope, and it was oversteepened. Then at 8:32 in the morning, at 17 seconds after 8:32, there was an earthquake, Richter magnitude 5.1, directly under the volcano, which dislodged the summit and north slope. So happens it happened in broad daylight, not a cloud in the sky, airplanes flying all around it, people on the ground photographing it. an airplane with a geologist was flying over a slide. Here you see the first rocks falling off of the summit at 8:32 in the morning. The earthquake had just occurred. The airplane is flying to the east, looking back to the west, and you can see part of the north slope has already slid away and is gone. And this is getting ready to slide away. In just a matter of seconds, it slid away. Airplane continued to fly to the east. Fortunately, it was not flying to the north as the steam blast started and directed northward over that landscape. On the ground, a geologist named Keith Ronholm was 10 miles away from the volcano, and he took these photographs. Here he is on the third ridge northeast of the volcano called Bear Meadows, looking back to the southwest at the volcano. The landslide has slid away. 1.5 cubic mile has slid into the Spirit Lake Basin and Tule River on the other side of that first ridge. And here is the beginning of the steam blast. Then on the other tripod, he had this telephoto lens. You can see the steam blast just a second or so later as it was developing here. You can see ballistic trajectory of rocks being thrown out. At 10 miles away, those rocks are as big as a city block, and they landed up to 8 miles away from the volcano. 20 million tons TNT explosion energy being released there as super hot liquid water is flashing to steam because the pressure inside the volcano was released as a landslide left. Here is this super hot blast cloud coming over the second ridge right here. It's moving at about 100 miles an hour, and it's 300 degrees centigrade, or about 550 degrees Fahrenheit, inside that cloud. And that's moving at twice freeway speed. Right about this time, the geologist taking these pictures made a very important decision. He said, "This steam blast cloud seems to be coming directly at me and at tremendous velocity." So he decided he was going to leave. And before he left and got in his vehicle, he took this over-the-shoulder shot coming over the third ridge. Only a geologist would do something that foolish, take a picture while he's being overcome by the volcano. But it so happens that third ridge did something very interesting. It deflected the cloud up into the air. Okay, it deflected up and it rose over the top of him. And before the cloud could fall back to the ground, he was able to get in his car and, moving at great speed, get some distance between him and the cloud. Okay, the weather satellite, 19,000 miles, 22,000 miles up in outer space, however far it is, took this photograph at 43 minutes after the eruption. At 9:15, the weather satellite took that photograph. And there you can see the effect of the steam blast cloud moving out from the summit area in the state of Washington. Then the afternoon of May 18, 1980, you see the whole western or eastern part of Washington is devastated by the volcanic ash in the atmosphere in northern Idaho and also Montana. Parts of Montana. During other eruptions, the volcanic ash got over into Alberta and over Portland and elsewhere. Then it erupted very violently for 9 hours. 9 hour eruption on May 18, 1980. During that 9 hour period, starting about 8:30 in the morning on May 18, 1980, the total energy output of the volcano was 400 million tons TNT explosion energy. 400 million tons TNT explosion energy was the energy released by the volcano in the 9 hour eruption. That's equivalent to 20,000 Hiroshima-sized atomic bombs. There's no hydrogen bomb in the world that big, okay? This is a big volcanic display of power. 1,000 Hiroshima-sized atomic bombs. And since there's 20,000 seconds in 9 hours, that's equivalent to one atomic bomb a second. That's how much energy the volcano was releasing when it was in full eruption with this gigantic volcanic ash plume above it. There's Yakima, Washington at noon on May 18th. Later, just a few minutes later, it got so dark the streetlights automatically turned on. And then it came back after the eruption, and you can see the northern area just north of the volcano looked like the moon. Volcanic ash everywhere. We call that pumice. Pumice is the name of the volcanic material, the volcanic frothy material that comes out of the volcano. Looking at it, magnified about 10,000 times actual size with electron microscope, this is what it looks like. It's a little sponge-like thing that's frothed up molten material that came out because of steam, frothed up into this kind of spongy-like particle, and then it cooled. It's volcanic ash at 10,000 times actual size. And there you see that north of the volcano, there was timber leveled all over. 150 square miles of timber was leveled in 6 minutes. Enough trees to build 640,000 three-bedroom homes. The inhabitants of this camper were killed. Two were killed there. Total of 60 people died in the volcanic eruption. Everybody went beyond the warning barriers and knew that they were in a high-hazard area. They did not heed the warnings. This is a logging crane that was tipped over by the force of the blast. This is a late model Pontiac Grand Prix. It was thrown across the road, about 2 miles from where Keith Ronholm took those photographs with a camera on the tripod. This car was thrown across the road 200 feet by the steam blast cloud. The tree fell across the trunk. Of course, the windows and glass was smashed. Everything that was rubber or plastic inside was vaporized, the dashboard, the steering wheel, seat covers, that type of thing. The tires did not burn, but they exploded or popped. And the paint job didn't come through too well either. How many of you remember Harry Truman? He appeared as a media sensation. He defied the authorities and said that he would not leave. His lodge was on the south shore of Spirit Lake, directly north of the summit, in the highest hazard area where the 50 feet of bulging was going on. His lodge was right below that area. He was buried on the morning of May 18th by this tremendous landslide, and he died that day. How many of you remember the media sensation? President Carter and the governor of Washington State went to see it. Mud flows were the major dollar damage caused by Mount St. Helens. On the left screen, you see a gigantic mud flow that was coming down one of the six major rivers that was devastated. Later, this bridge was washed away. This is a logging camp on the right that was overcome by the force of the moving mud. Looks like a child's play box or something like that, but it is, that's a whole logging camp there with trucks and things. Major devastation way downstream, far away from the volcano where nobody could even hear the force of the blast. You could see the moving mud. This valley was filled up to that level with moving mud. 20 feet of mud to 30 feet of mud in this valley, and there's about 10 feet of mud that was deposited on the bottom of this valley the man is standing on. So that's the level, and that mud was moving in some places at the along the margin of the volcano, 60 miles an hour. Away down here, it was moving at maybe just 5 or 10 miles an hour. But it scoured the valley down to bedrock. Now, how do we know how deep the mud was? Well, we can look at the trees around the valley. You can see the bathtub ring on the tree showing you how high the mud was. It was moving through there. Now, how about the crater itself? Everybody's interested in what's going on in there. Notice something very interesting. See, inside the crater, there's this gigantic mushroom-shaped gob of rock that's been forced up in the neck of the volcano. It's called a lava dome. Lava dome is this cork that kind of sits there and exerts pressure. And as it cracks, it swells, and molten material is forced into the cracks, and this thing continues to get bigger and bigger. This is the one I took last summer when I was in there. You can see the lava dome, how big it's been getting. It's something like as high as a 28-story building and half a mile in diameter. There have been six lava domes in there. This is the sixth. And the earlier one, it shows you an earlier lava dome, that was kicked out by a subsequent eruption after, I believe, in late 1980. Here again, looking down on an earlier lava dome, it's in the neck of the volcano, and it's swollen rock in there with cracks. And you can see the hot rock in the cracks. there were no lava flows from Mount St. Helens, just the swelling of the lava dome itself. One day we went in to see the lava dome. Now, this is not recommended activity. So we went in to see the lava dome, and we felt that we had radio communication, so we were able to go in there to see it. And we were very careful as we went in to see it. Here we are getting in a little closer to this thing. Rocks falling off of the lava dome and inside of the crater all around us here. There is, it sounded like sonic booms continually as gigantic rocks were sliding off the inside. We didn't go too far in, but a very active geologic environment. And there's a lava dome, steam coming out of it as it cracks continually. On the morning of, or on the evening of March 30th, 1984, the lava dome cracked very abruptly. And a friend of mine took this time exposure, 5-minute time exposure at night, and you can see the hot rock inside the crack of the lava dome. He was offered, I think, $25,000 for the original to that negative. It was a real interesting shot. I haven't seen one like that. I had to trade 2 slides for that one. Now, how about the lake north of the volcano? You see a Spirit Lake. It's about a 5-square-mile lake. The landslide went into the lake, through the lake, up to 860 feet above the pre-eruption level. The lake slid back into its new basin as 300 feet of landslide debris was deposited in there. And so it has a new level, about 260 feet above the pre-eruption level. And you see all these trees floating on the lake. Those trees were up on those slopes up in there, up to 800 feet above the pre-eruption level of the lake. And they were sheared off as the water came back in. Now, these are trees that are floating over water. Okay, it's not a beach here. I took this photograph one afternoon, and I came back 2 hours later. The wind changed, and the logs floated back into this cove. You see this little cove right here, that point of land? There's that point of land. Here's that cove. So this log mat moves around. The log mat's about 3 square miles in area. It covers a little more than half the lake. And so we've been very interested in that. Here you can see part of the lake covered with logs entirely. The water was shoved out of the lake bed by the landslide up onto this platform, formed a gigantic vortex, sheared off all the trees and scoured it clean, went back into the lake. That's about 500 feet above the pre-eruption level of the lake, or 300 feet above the present lake. And this slope here was not scoured by the wave. I would trade all of my slides for one of those, of that giant wave. Nobody has a photograph of that, I understand. That would really be worth seeing, to see a wave like that go up over the side of that hill. There's the log mat from the lake. We were able to get into the lake and study the logs in the lake. Well, let's talk about some of the amazing geologic events that occurred there at the volcano. For example, here you see the pumice deposits just directly north of the volcano at the south shore of Spirit Lake. And there's been up to 600 feet of deposits that have occurred in the last 6 years, 6.5 years since the eruption. The whole North Fork of the Toodle River down there was devastated by landslide debris, and then also the volcanic ash deposits landed there, up to 600 feet in thickness. And you look at those deposits, some that formed in a matter of just a day, and you can see a tremendous organization and layering. And because we have photographs at all stages of the eruption and between eruptions of what was going on, we can understand when these layers formed. This layer right down here where the lady is standing is about, that's the May 18th volcanic ash deposits. This is the June 12th volcanic eruption deposits, and This is the March 19th, 1982 mud flow deposit. And what is interesting is to look at these deposits and see what happened during one day's activity. On June 12th, 1980, a series of surge-like pulses of volcanic debris came out of the crater, a cascading avalanche of material. And look what it deposited, a layered deposit, a catastrophe. In very short order, less than a day. We don't actually know how long it was because nobody was there. It was 300 degrees centigrade watching us. Here we are looking at the June 12th layers again, a little bit closer up, you can see the layering involved here. Now, geologists are accustomed to thinking in terms of long ages for the formation of individual layers, such as the Grand Canyon layers. You know, those layers are thought to be built up over millions of years. Yet right here, we have the formations, the layers that formed in just a matter of a day, less than a day, on June 12, 1980. Here we are looking again at the very precise layering in the June 12th deposits as these flows came out of the crater. Even closer up look at it, you can see the distinct, very minute banding. Now, the geologists might think in terms of each layer or thin laminae or lamina representing maybe 1 year or 2 years or something like that. It's alternation between summer and winter, or between years where we had drought and years where we had a lot of water. Seeing this happen, it kind of astounds us. Now, we knew that we could do this because in our laboratories, in special tanks, we had made these kind of layers. But now we discovered that they can happen naturally in the earth, right at the volcano. Well, think about the deposits at Yellowstone National Park. We see the same thing. A volcanic explosion on a colossal scale, perhaps 2,000 times Mount St. Helens size. And again, we see the layering. Now, these deposits might not have taken hundreds or thousands of years to form, and individual layers representing individual eruptions, they might be related to one eruption. And so volcanic catastrophe on a major scale there at Yellowstone, indicated by Mount St. Helens. Now, another thing about Mount St. Helens was a large amount of erosion occurred. This slide on the left shows up near the crater. We were up walking up there by the crater, and we went into a canyon. A new canyon system had formed since 1980. And this is hard rock. This is an old lava flow, a prehistoric lava flow, a prehistoric landslide deposit, and a prehistoric volcanic ash bed that were eroded by mud flows and broken volcanic debris ejected from the crater. This canyon here is about 100 feet deep, and as you go up by the crater, it gets over 300 feet deep. This canyon formed since 1980. And then the lake has a new level. It's 260 feet above the pre-eruption level of the lake. And within 12 months of the lake being established at its new level, look at this, a wave-cut cliff about 20 feet tall. And so coastal erosion or shoreline erosion doesn't have to occur and happen very slowly. We've seen canyon systems eroded and shorelines eroded rapidly. Now, there were secondary steam explosions that were occurring north of the volcano. The landslide material contained gigantic chunks of ice, and they were buried under 300-degree hot pumice. And within days, the buried ice had vaporized and turned into steam and was reaming holes to the surface. And here you see the south shore of Spirit Lake with a steam ejection here, reaming a hole through the pumice deposits from the landslide material buried underneath. And these steam explosions, secondary steam explosions, were kind of interesting, so we got to studying those. And here shows the largest steam explosion pit. There's the south shore of the lake, and the volcano is up on the upper right here. And this pit is being reamed by the steam that's being ejected from the from underneath. And this pit is photographed here on May 23rd, 5 days after May 18th. And this pit is 1,000 feet across, 2,000 feet long, and 125 feet deep, was reamed by steam jetting up from underneath. Now, if you look at this very carefully, this profile and outline here is the same that was photographed over here on the right screen on June 18th, just 30 days after the May 18th eruption. And you'll see that this terrain here is very interesting. It had all been acquired in the profile of that landscaping here. It had all been formed in the first 5 days, probably by slumping of material around the pit. And so this is a little different perspective on the right screen than on the left screen here, but you're looking back at that very interesting gullied kind of terrain. Now, I'd been out in the desert, you know, looking at the landscapes out in the Mojave Desert, and you see this kind of gullied topography and terrain all the time. Geologists are accustomed to thinking in terms of hundreds or even thousands of years for this to slowly form. Yet right around the lip of the steam explosion pit, we had it within 5 days, forming not by water erosion in this case, but by slumping of the lip of the pit. And then the June 12, 1980 volcanic flow deposits came in and filled the bottom of the pit 25 feet deep and made that layered and bedded deposit we saw before. So the effects of erosion are visible on a tremendous scale. So he went in there to go see that area, and the Institute for Creation Research geologists went in to that area to look at it. Over a period of 4 years, we've been studying that area. Here is that same area, that gully terrain. We're looking back to the west, down the North Fork of the Toutle River. And what is amazing is, as you look out over that terrain, is you can hardly recognize it. That area, this big steam explosion pit, was breached on March 19, 1982, by a mud flow that came out of the crater. And the mud flow came down like this, filled in the pit, then breached through the pit, and eroded the pit away, so you don't see the outline or form of the pit very well. You have a new gullied terrain with a canyon system running down through here. In fact, not just one canyon, but five canyons come together as the mud went down through there. It devastated that area and carved a new canyon system in the volcanic material, the landslide material in the volcanic ash. There are freestanding cliffs up to 140 feet tall. And this canyon was breached. Here's the old mud, the old pit that was breached by the mud flow. That comes down and joins up this canyon on the right, and that goes down toward the west to the Pacific Ocean. There's two other canyons coming in over there. A series of canyon systems come to our attention right there. You know, as we were thinking about this, what should come to mind but the Grand Canyon? We're looking at the Grand Canyon, the little Grand Canyon of the Toutle River. And it is. It's kind of a miniature canyon system, and if you let yourself kind of magnify the scale, it looks like the Grand Canyon. It's 1/40th scale model of the Grand Canyon. Here shows the old steam explosion pit where it was breached right through there, and you can see the high cliffs and a large amount of erosion. This is the Wright Canyon on that previous slide, and you see the 140-foot tall cliff standing there. Oh, it's about eighth of a mile wide, and what do you see but a little creek running down through that canyon? Now, we would normally think in terms of slow and gradual erosion forming that canyon, and geologists would just say conventionally, in reasoning from what we know and have experienced, if we hadn't seen the volcanic eruption, we'd say, well, this little dinky creek flowing down through this canyon took thousands, maybe even millions of years at once, particle at a time, removing the debris to form this canyon. There's a wide-angle lens looking at that whole canyon system there, going down there, the new headwaters of the Toutle River. We have a new canyon system. This shows that little creek again, and you might suppose that was formed by that creek, but we have living proof that mud went down through there, made this canyon. It wasn't made by water moving through there, it was mud. And on the top of the cliff there is a man for scale. Okay, the force of erosion breached that in 1 day. Well, one day I was sitting next to Spirit Lake eating my lunch when what should catch my attention but some sticks floating in the water. You see, look at these sticks here, broken plant material laying on the lake, floating prone. And then you can see upright sticks floating there in the lake, edge of the lake. And they're floating off a little bit out of the water here, and they're floating off the bottom. They do not cast a shadow. And these over here have floated in. The wind blew them over, and they floated in vertical position and landed. Isn't that kind of interesting? And you can look at the vertical stems, the two of them right here, and you can see that they're standing off the bottom. They don't cast a shadow. But then you can see these little sticks are standing on the bottom, okay, but they cast a shadow. Here's another stick right here. It casts a shadow behind it. Then you can see a lot of prone material laying over flat on the bottom. So this was kind of an interesting day to contemplate the volcanic effects. So what should come to mind but what I call a grand hypothesis about how the trees might float in the lake? These trees are just big sticks. So here we are, prone floating tree. What could happen? The same thing. They could float in upright position in the water, be an upright floating log. Then because the root end, the bottom of the tree is more dense wood, it has to support the upper part of the tree, and because it might be mired down with rocks and things in the roots or something like that, it would float in vertical position like this. As it became soaked, it would sink to the bottom and could stand upright, be an upright deposited log. At least the way we're looking at this pond, it might indicate that that's the case. And then the tree could be buried. Since sedimentation is occurring rapidly in Spirit Lake, you could bury the trees. And since they're dropping out at different times, they could be buried at different levels. You have a tree buried at this level, a tree buried at that level, a tree buried at that level, and even a tree standing right on the bottom of the lake. Well, if you saw these trees buried inside the earth at different levels, you might assume that there are several forests that grew here over thousands and thousands of years. For example, this tree rooted at this level, you might assume that there was a soil developed on this horizon over thousands of years, and then a forest developed, hundreds of years of growth of trees. Then what would happen? We had burial again, and then you had a forest develop at this level hundreds of years later, thousands of years maybe, deposition, then finally a third forest at this level. This tree fell over and was buried, and then finally a fourth forest could grow at that level. So you could, if you saw this buried in the earth in cross-section, you might suppose thousands of years involved with the formation of these trees penetrating through layers of strata. So we decided we would check out this hypothesis about the vertical flotation of logs by going into Spirit Lake with a boat. So we got a boat, boat with a small motor on it, out in the lake, and we have a sonar recorder here, a side-scan sonar. There's the recording device, and here is our automobile batteries, car batteries, there they are in the back of the boat, that powers the recorder. And then we have the sonar towfish. This is a sonar device you lower over the edge of the boat, and it sends out the sound and it echoes back what it sees. And here's the recorder. It gives off a paper copy looking out diagonally over the bottom of the lake. And look what we see as we look out over the lake. Here is the sonar position right here. We're looking out through the water, and we see the echo coming back from some object right there. And behind it is an enormous shadow. Okay, here's another echo and a shadow behind it, another echo, shadow behind it. It looks like some large objects are standing off the bottom of the lake, on the lake, and casting a shadow over the bottom of the lake, the way our sonar is looking at it. Here we are, we have another sonar reading. We have an echo, a direct return from an object above the bottom of the lake and then going down to the bottom of the lake, and there's the shadow behind it. And here's another direct echo off of some object standing in the water on the bottom of the lake, up off the bottom with a shadow behind it. Here's another direct reflection, and there's the object behind it. It has a flaring out profile at the base. It looks like it's casting a shadow. We have a large mass of roots there. You can kind of see, just looks like a tree, doesn't it? Just standing there. And so another evidence of some large objects we interpreted to be trees on the bottom of the lake. This one, we see 14 upright objects standing on the bottom of the lake, casting shadows. We surveyed a small portion of the lake, about 1% of the lake, and had hundreds of contacts with upright objects on the bottom of the lake. We interpret these to be trees standing on the bottom of the lake, and extrapolating to the whole bottom of the lake, 5 square mile area of the lake, there must be 20,000 upright stumps standing there summer of 1985 when we did the survey. So if you drain Spirit Lake, it would look like a forest standing there. Of trees. That's what the sonar was suggesting to us. So we decided we'd go diving in Spirit Lake, scuba diving. And I'm a NAWI certified open water diver. And as I originally contemplate doing that, it did sound kind of hazardous. Right there next to the active volcano in a lake choked with logs and trees, diving in the soup that's very, very poor visibility, and it's also very cold water there. Here I am decked out in my diving gear, And there's my diving buddy this one day. Here we are again. We're going out another day, going diving in the lake. As far as I know, we're the only ones to do any diving there in the lake. And probably nobody else is foolhardy enough to go diving in that situation. Here we are. We're out in the lake. That's my diving buddy. There I am. We're getting ready to go down underneath the floating log mat. You see the logs all around us. There's the volcano in the background. Here we are out in the lake, and we saw an upright stump right there. There's the volcano in the background for realism. We're getting ready to go down to see if this tree is actually standing on the bottom. And it was. It verified this hypothesis about how trees float. And then we went over to one place and we saw a whole bunch of trees that had floated over there in upright position and were dropped and deposited. And one summer we went back in there underneath a floating log mat with all those upright stumps and went diving in there. It was amazing. And wasn't hazardous at all. I felt secure in the diving situations that I were in. This aerial photograph of the log mat floating on the lake, and you see these upright floaters in this one area. They look like little straws floating upright. Hundreds of upright floaters. Whoops, must have missed something there. Well, that slide didn't drop in. I don't know what it was. But we'll go on to the next one. Yeah, the bottom of the lake we saw were all kinds of upright stumps were landed on the bottom of the lake. Standing upright on the bottom of the lake were the logs. Diving verified them. The sonar would show one. We would throw an anchor overboard with a little float on it, and we'd go down dive, and we'd land right on top of some of these trees, giant trees up to 12 feet in diameter on the bottom. Here are three trees. They're usually spaced, but this one, there are three of them together. Here's a tree. Here's a root mass of a tree, and there's a third tree over there. Verified the sonar and suggested that this idea about how logs float in the lake is true. Here's a tree that was probably growing on a 45-degree slope. And it was growing off at an angle. See that? Growing off at an angle. I think that this tree was growing on a 45-degree slope with the roots radiating out parallel to slope, and this was growing straight up into the air. The wave came along, removed the tree from the slope, and then it was floated back in the lake, and it dropped to the bottom. Whoops, missed that slide again. Moving on. Petrified Forest National Park, or Petrified Forest in Yellowstone National Park. This is kind of interesting because we have seen at Spirit Lake something very interesting, upright deposition and flotation of trees and dropping to the bottom. Can you imagine the significance of this? It challenges our way of thinking about how trees and fossil wood occurs in the earth. For example, at the sign at Specimen Ridge in Yellowstone National Park, we see this display. Across the valley rise the slopes of Specimen Ridge, but the forest you see there today is only the latest chapter in a remarkable story. Buried within the volcanic rocks that compose the mountain are 27 distinct layers of fossil forest that flourished 50 million years ago. Now, how do they know that those trees grew there 50 million years ago, and there's great periods of millions of years involved with that one cliff at Yellowstone, at Specimen Ridge in Yellowstone? They assume that the trees grew there. The right sign shows us a little bit more detail. Yellowstone's fossil forests are unique. They're the world's most extensive, cover 40 square miles. They contain the greatest variety of plants, over 100 species, right, in the same sites where they grew millions of years ago. And this whole idea of millions of years being inside the slope there at Yellowstone is being challenged now by the bottom of Spirit Lake. The trees are dropping out at different times and are being buried at different levels. Some of those trees are already solidly buried. I can't shake them when I go down there diving. Other trees have landed just recently in the bottom. You can see the roots. They're flaring out over the bottom of the lake. Others are solidly embedded. And so it looks like Mount St. Helens has a better explanation, or just as good an explanation, for those fossil forests at Yellowstone, and that geologists need to think differently when they see upright stumps beautifully fossilized in the earth. This shows two of the upright trees, very beautifully agatized, standing out of the slope there at Yellowstone. Now, reasoning from the poverty of our ignorance of the present, and looking at the forest back here in the background, you say, oh, sure, that's just the ancient forest that was buried there. And not even consider this alternate idea about how Mount St. Helens is buried trees. And you would assume and suppose conclusively that this slope represented millions of years. Here's another look at one of those beautifully agatized trees standing upright out of the slope at Yellowstone. Again, we need to have our way of thinking changed, because that whole layered box there at Specimen Ridge in Yellowstone looks a lot like Mount St. Helens and Spirit Lake in detail, the volcanic rocks all around it. And the creationists now are starting to publish this information. I'm getting ready to publish papers on Spirit Lake and others challenging the conventional way of thinking, the ordinary thought about how trees are buried in the earth. Well, one day I was thinking about the origin of coal, and I was working on my PhD dissertation at Pennsylvania State University, and I was looking at this lump of coal, this block of coal and other coal that I was studying in the state of Kentucky, and what should catch my attention but the layered and laminated appearance of the coal. Have you ever looked at a lump of coal and seen the layering in it? It's not homogeneous material, it's layered material. And looking at this under the microscope and studying it in detail, I discovered large sheets of bark were one of the primary components of the coal beds that we have in the eastern United States. And the layered appearance is very interesting. The conventional way of thinking is that coal forms over thousands of years by slow accumulation of plant material in swamps. As you build up a thick layer of peat, the organic decay is prevented by the water-saturated condition, and the spongy layer of peat builds up. And it might take 1,000 years for each inch of coal to form in a swamp as this accumulates slowly and gradually. Well, I was looking at the block of coal here, and I'm saying, I don't think that's been rotted in the swamp thousands of years. I think there might be some other explanation for it. For example, look at a modern peat deposit along the shore of Nova Scotia. The shoreline erosion has removed the drained the swamp, and the trees are gone. This is accumulated just a few tens of years ago. And there you see the peat deposit, the organic material that formed in the swamp. It's brown and homogeneous. It's not structured or layered. And it has large fragments in it. You see these large fragments. Look like branches hanging out. What are those? Those are the roots. And modern swamp peats are intensely root penetrated, and it destroys the organization. It homogenizes the structure, and you have kind of coffee grounds intruded by roots. That's what modern peat deposits look like. And that would make something, if it got buried and heated, it would make some kind of coal quite different than the coals we've seen in the eastern United States. So one day I was taking a bath, contemplating the problem of the origin of coal, these layers of bark laying in the coal bed, and not understanding how that could be deposited. When I was playing with soap suds, floating mat model came to my attention, in my mind. Can you imagine trees floating on an ocean or in a water mass, and wherever the trees would float, they would rub against one another, and you would peel off the bark, and the bark would fall to the bottom, it'd be water soaked, and would land on the bottom, you'd have a thick layer of sheets of bark. And it would form a peat layer, and it could be later buried very rapidly and be converted to coal. And it explained the layered appearance of coal and some other things that were interesting. Well, in 1979, at Pennsylvania State University, I defended this model for the origin of coal that I had in my bathtub. And 10 months later, Mount St. Helens blew up and made the living example of a floating log mat. Here you see all of Spirit Lake, 5 square miles in area right after the eruption. About 3/4 of the lake is covered with millions of logs, billions of logs, I suppose. Logs everywhere on the surface of the lake. Notice how brown it is. That's because the bark is on the trees. Now, look at this, just this summer when we was out there. Notice something very interesting? No bark. The bark is gone. Where'd it go? It sunk to the bottom, so we decided we'd go down and actually study the bottom of the lake. The bottom, going down underneath the log mat with my underwater camera looking up at the log mat, you can see the thousands of tons of logs up above as the sun comes streaming through. No bark. It's all been rubbed off. Again, looking at the log mat again, looking up at the underneath the logs. On the bottom of the lake, bark everywhere. About 25% of the organic material laying on the bottom of the lake is bark. And there are thick layers of peat, over 3 feet thick in places on the bottom of the lake. The first step for the formation of coal in the floating log mat model is the deposition of the material on the bottom. Here you see a gigantic sheet of bark over 5 feet long, kind of laying separate on the bottom there. Usually it's buried flat in the lake. Looking directly down on the bottom of the lake, you see a sheet of bark laying there next to a sheet of bark, laying on top of a sheet of bark. Okay, bark deposits on the bottom of the lake are very abundant. And it would make that layered appearance of the coal we see in the eastern United States. My diving buddy picked up a sheet of bark off the bottom. There's a little piece of bark there. Again, another looking sheet of bark. It's very easy to find. Here's a gigantic sheet of bark, over 8 feet long. I can't even get my camera to photograph it. But it's only 2 inches thick, and it's 8 feet long, laying on the bottom of the lake. We picked that up. Bark everywhere. Trees, broken trees laying down the bottom of the lake, and more bark laying over the lake. Can you imagine large masses of trees floating in an ocean in a gigantic log mat in the state of Kentucky? Okay, so far from an ocean, and we see ocean evidence, marine fossils, sea creatures interspersed with a coal bed. And it brings to mind a great masses of plants, probably half the size of the state of Kentucky, floating over the state of Kentucky. Something like that is hard to imagine. It brings to mind a catastrophe like the flood, not just a small volcano anymore, but a catastrophe on a large scale. Ripping loose trees, large masses of trees, mats covering thousands of square miles, floating across a continent. Everywhere they float, underneath, they would deposit the peat as the logs and trees rub together, depositing the bark as it's water-soaked on the bottom. This idea is the floating log mat model for the origin of coal, that one I defended at Pennsylvania State University. It brings to mind Noah's flood. Okay, some large catastrophe, water catastrophe on a general scale. And so it looks like our coal beds in the center of the United States provide evidence that the ocean was over the continent rafting trees on an immense scale. Catastrophe on large order and taxes our way of thinking about how the earth works. You ever thought about the significance of the volcanic eruption as it affects you and I and our way of thinking about the earth? Right there on May 18, 1980, okay, in one day, 400 million tons TNT explosion energy was released, equivalent to 20,000 atomic bombs. It's scriptural to study this from looking at it from God's perspective. For example, Psalm 46 says, "Come, behold the works of the Lord, what devastations he has made in the earth." And look at this is definitely a devastation, 150 square mile area. And the Bible talks about volcanoes. Psalm 104, verse 32 says, "He looks upon the earth and it trembles." God just looks down from heaven on the earth and we have an earthquake. He doesn't even do anything. You just look and it trembles. We have an earthquake. God, it goes on to say, Psalm 104, verse 32, "He touches the mountains and they smoke." God reaches down with his little finger, 400 million tons TNT explosion energy in just his little finger. Think about that. Incredible power involved in the volcano and reflecting in our minds the power of God. And then think about the tremendous volcanoes that have been going off, like the Yellowstone volcano, 2,000 times this size, brings to mind incredible power. The Bible says his hand formed the dry land. One hand, Psalm 95, his hand formed the dry land. The Bible also says, Jeremiah 32:17, he created all things by his great power and by his outstretched arm. Took his arm to make the whole universe that we see. We see displayed in nature incredible power, and the volcano is just in a minor form showing this power. Mount St. Helens is just a small to average volcano. As men watched the volcanic eruption, we saw colossal power, and we realized something. We were not in control. The humanist, the person who believes that he's in master of his own destiny and in control of everything around him, is humbled when looking at the volcano, because we see power unleashed far in excess of man's power, not under control by man. It shows God is sovereign over human affairs. The volcano shows God's sovereignty. As, you know, thinking about this volcano, the idea of God's grace come to my mind. Here we have a volcano that exploded with tremendous power, but it's only a small to average volcano. The tremendous volcanic eruptions that made Yellowstone and other great volcanic areas are thousands of times bigger than Mount St. Helens. God is not devastating the earth, volcanoes today, just small to average volcanoes like Mount St. Helens going off. No great volcanic cataclysms. And so God seems to be gracious, not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. And I see a little bit about God's meekness in a volcano. Have you thought about the volcano and the power about the volcano and just being part of God's power? And then think about how God has dealt with us in human history. He came and laid in a manger. He didn't display his power. He was lowly and meek among us. Very interesting to think about the effect of the volcano on our way of thinking. You know, when if you would have talked to me 7 years ago and said there would be a volcanic eruption that would occur today, later, that's going to make all of these various features that you see, we've seen and I've described, I would have got into an argument with you because I thought I knew all about how the earth worked and about how things formed in the earth. I had my PhD in geology. And yet, I was humbled by looking at the amazing things the volcano accomplished in very short order. It made 600 feet of deposits, some of them precisely layered. It also did some amazing erosional features, a miniature Grand Canyon, 1/40th scale model. It deposited trees in upright position on the bottom of the lake, buried at different levels, having the appearance of a forest that grew there. And it formed a peat layer on the bottom of the lake, very similar to coal, the first step in the formation of coal. All of this kind of challenged my way of thinking and asking questions about how the earth works. You know, I learned that God specializes in doing things that I think, in my ordinary way of reasoning, are impossible. Things like this just happen to be going on. And it causes me to wonder about Noah's flood in particular and think about the catastrophes that have actually made the earth, thinking about coal layers and canyons and strata and those kind of things. I hope in the last few minutes you have communicated a little bit about what a volcano is like. It's an amazing thing, isn't it? A volcano in its basic operation is incredible. I hope you can understand a little bit about my activity and involvement in the volcanic eruption. I was there before, during, and after the volcanic eruption, and so have experienced it in kind of a direct way, and how it affected my life and caused me to ask questions, searching myself about who I am and how I'm working. And a little bit of, hope it communicates a little bit about what I'm doing involved as a creationist and as a catastrophist studying the force of the volcano and what it can do. And then I've explained some very unusual things about what a volcano can do. It can cause those strata formations, and it can cause canyons to be eroded and deposit trees in upright position and bury layers of peat in the lake looking like coal beds and a number of things. And I hope the volcano challenges you to think about the sovereignty of God, the power of God, the grace of God, the humility of God, and even challenges your way of thinking about the earth and challenges you personally to live by faith. all this is kind of what I see there at Mount St. Helens. It'll be remembered as one of the most significant geologic events of our generation, of our probably our century. And what it did challenges us to believe in God's power in other ways. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Dr. Stephen Austin. I get the impression we could have a lot more on that. Fantastic. I'd like to add a personal note. Your slide on Yakima, Washington, the day of the explosion. I was there, right there in Yakima, Washington. I can verify 3-4 inches of soot were all over the ground even before noon. I was preaching there on prophecy and was mentioning earthquakes that morning. And I appreciate God giving us a vivid illustration of that. Well, I hope you're challenged to consider getting his book, and it will be available after our final session tonight. It's a joy to have these men with us. We have men who have studied their areas and are speaking out of their own experience and expertise. And the man that's coming right now, Donald Chittick, needless to say, has been mightily used in this whole field. He has a Bachelor of Science in Chemistry. We heard first from a geologist, now a chemist, from Willamette University, a Doctor of Philosophy in Physical Chemistry from Oregon State University. He has a long list of his teaching credentials. He's been involved in research and development and energy and all kinds of chemical projects. He's a member of a number of professional organizations. He's listed in American Men and Women of Science, the Dictionary of International Biography of Who's Who in the West and Midwest, and he's author of numerous articles, symposiums he's been a part of dealing with science and creation, and of recent days, he is the author of the wonderful selling book by Multnomah Press, The Controversy, which is the roots of the creation-evolution conflict in this country, and this is the author, and he's with us here tonight. He was, in 1970, selected as Outstanding Educator of America. He's married, has a daughter, Annie, who's 24. He lives in Oregon. We're just delighted to have Dr. Donald Chittick with us tonight. But before he comes, we're going to quickly change the slide. He has slides also. Let's all stand for 5 minutes or so.